Hello, hello, welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Hope you're doing well. Yeah, I mean, it's been such a long time. I really have not had the space or the time to record in a while, so if the comments are turned on this video, I'm still trying to figure out like why they're turned off sometimes, why they're on, but if they're on, let me know how you are. Let me know how you like this book. Again, apologies for some of the street noise. We're gonna try to do our best to work around it, but I really did not want to go any longer without getting into another section of this bad boy. And if you're new here, hi, I'm Julie, and we read books on this channel, and this is our current fall read, and as it is fall, it's a little chilly, so cozy up. I feel like this is really a cozy read, you know what I mean? So yeah, let's jump right in. We are on page 65, if you're following along in a copy such as this one. And this chapter, I suppose, is called An Assembly. Oh, come along. I'd rather not. Don't be such a fuddy-duddy. I'm not a fuddy-duddy. Can you be so sure? A man can never be entirely sure that he is not a fuddy-duddy. That is axiomatic to the term. Exactly. In this manner, Nina coerced the Count to join her in one of her favorite excursions, spying from the balcony of the ballroom. The Count was reluctant to accompany Nina on this particular journey for two reasons. First, the ballroom's balcony was narrow and dusty, and to stay out of sight, one was forced to remain hunched behind the balustrade, a decidedly uncomfortable position for a grown man over 6 feet tall. The last time the Count had accompanied Nina to the balcony, he had torn the seam of his pants, and it took 3 days for him to lose the crick in his neck. But second, this afternoon's gathering was almost certain to be another assembly. Over the course of the summer, the assemblies had been occurring at the hotel with increasing frequency. At various times of day, small groups of men would come barreling through the lobby, already gesticulating, interrupting, and eager to make their points. In the ballroom, they would join their brethren, milling shoulder to shoulder, every other one of them puffing on a cigarette. As best as the Count could determine, the Bolsheviks assembled whenever possible, in whichever form, for whatever reason. In a single week, there might be committees, caucuses, colloquiums, congresses, and conventions variously coming together to establish codes, set courses of action, levy complaints, and generally clamor about the world's oldest problems in its newest nomenclature. If the Count was reluctant to observe these gatherings, it was not because he found the ideological leanings of the attendees distasteful. He would no sooner have crouched behind a balustrade to watch Cicero debating Catiline or Hamlet debating himself. No, it was not a matter of ideology. Simply put, the Count found political discourse of any persuasion to be tedious. But then, wasn't that exactly what a fuddy-duddy would argue? Needless to say, the Count followed Nina up the stairs to the second floor. Having skirted the entrance to the Boyarsky and ensured the coast was clear, they used Nina's key to open the unmarked door to the balcony. Down below, 100 men were already in their chairs, and another 100 were conferring in the aisles, as three impressive fellows took their seats behind a long wooden table on the dais, which is to say the assembly had nearly assembled. As this was the 2nd of August, and there had already been two assemblies earlier that day, the temperature in the ballroom was 91 degrees. Nina skirted out behind the balustrade on her hands and knees. When the Count bent over to do the same, the seam in the back of his pants gave way again. "Merde," he muttered. "Shh," said Nina. The first time the Count had joined Nina on the balcony, he couldn't help but feel some astonishment at how profoundly the life of the ballroom had changed. Not 10 years before, all of Moscow society would have been gathered in their finery under the grand chandeliers to dance the mazurka and toast the Tsar. But after witnessing a few of the assemblies, the Count had come to an even more astonishing conclusion, that despite the revolution, the room had barely changed at all. At that very moment, for example, two young men were coming through the doors, looking game for the fray, but
Before exchanging a word with the soul, they crossed the room in order to pay their respects to an old man seated by the wall. Presumably, this elder had taken part in the 1905 revolution, or penned a pamphlet in 1880, or dined with Karl Marx back in 1852. Whatever his claim to eminence, the old revolutionary acknowledged the deference of the two young Bolsheviks with a self-assured nod of the head, all while sitting in the very chair from which the Grand Duchess Anna Pavlovna had received the greetings of dutiful young princes at her annual Easter ball. Or consider the charming-looking chap who, in the manner of Prince Tetrakov, was now touring the room, shaking hands and patting backs, having systematically made an impression in every corner, with a weighty remark here and a witty remark there. He now excused himself for just a moment. But once through the door, he will not reappear, for having ensured that everyone in the ballroom has noted his attendance, he will now head off to an altogether different sort of assembly, one that is to take place in a cozy little room in the Arbat. Later, no doubt, some dashing young Turk who is rumored to have Lenin's ear will make a point of arriving when the business of the evening is nearly done, just as Captain Radyanko had when he had the ear of the Tsar, thus exhibiting his indifference to the smaller conventions of etiquette while reinforcing his reputation as a man with so much to attend to and so little time to attend to it. Of course, there is now more canvas than cashmere in the room, more gray than gold, but is the patch on the elbow really that much different from the epaulette on the shoulder? Aren't those workday chaps donned like the Bicorn and Shako before them? In order to strike a particular note, or take that bureaucrat on the dais with his gal. Surely he can afford a tailored jacket and a creased pair of pants. If he is wearing this ragged fare, it is in order to assure all assembled that he is too hardened member of the working class. As if hearing the count's thoughts, this secretary suddenly rapped his gavel on the tabletop, calling to order the second meeting of the First Congress of the Moscow branch of the All-Russian Union of Railway Workers. The doors were closed, seats were taken, Nina held her breath, and the assembly was underway. In the first 15 minutes, 6 different administrative matters were raised and dispensed with in quick succession, leading one to imagine that this particular assembly might actually be concluded before one's back gave out. But next on the docket was a subject that proved more contentious. It was a proposal to amend the union's charter, or more precisely, the 7th sentence of the 2nd paragraph, which the secretary now read in full. Here, indeed, was a formidable sentence, one that was on intimate terms with the comma, and that held the period in healthy disregard. For its apparent purpose was to catalogue without fear or hesitation every single virtue of the Union, including, but not limited to, its unwavering shoulders, its undaunted steps, the clanging of its hammers in summer, the shoveling of its coal in winter, and the hopeful sound of its whistles in the night. But in the concluding phrases of this impressive sentence, at the very culmination, as it were, was the observation that through their tireless efforts, the railway workers of Russia facilitate communication and trade across the provinces. After all the build-up, it was a bit of an anticlimax, conceded the count. But the objection being raised was not due to the phrase's overall lack of verve. Rather, it was due to the word facilitate. Specifically, the verb had been accused of being so tepid and prim that it failed to do justice to the labors of the men in the room. "We're not helping a lady put on her jacket," someone shouted from the rear, "or painting her nails." "Hear, hear!" Well, fair enough. But what verb would better express the work of the union? What verb would do justice to the sweaty devotion of the engineers, the unflagging vigilance of the brakemen, and the rippling muscles of those who laid the tracks? A flurry of proposals came from the floor. To spur, to propel, to empower. The The merits and limitations of each of these alternatives were hotly debated. There were three pointed arguments counted on out on fingertips, rhetorical questions, emotional summations, and back row catcalls punctuated by the banging of the gavel. As the ambient temperature of the balcony rose to 96 degrees. Then, just as the count began to sense some risk of riot, a suggestion came from a shy-looking lad in the 10th row that perhaps to facilitate could be replaced with to enable and ensure. This pairing, the lad explained, while his cheeks grew red as a raspberry, might encompass not only the laying of rails and the manning of engines, but the ongoing maintenance of the system. Yes, that's it. Laying, manning, and maintenance. To enable and ensure. With hearty applause from every corner, the lad's proposal seemed to be barreling toward adoption as quickly and dependably as one of the Union's locomotive barrels across the steppe. But just as it was nearing its terminus, a rather scrawny fellow in the second row stood. Such a wisp of a man was he that one wondered how he had secured a position in the Union in the first place. Once he had the attention of the room, this back office clerk or accountant, this all-Russian pusher of pencils, asserted a voice as tepid and prim as the word facilitate. Poetic concision demands the avoidance of a pair of words when a single word will suffice. What's that? What did he say? Several stood up with the intention of grabbing him by the collar and dragging him from the room, but before they could get their hands on him, a burly fellow in the fifth row spoke, without rising to his feet. With all due respect to poetic concision, the male of the species was endowed with a pair when a single might have sufficed. Thunderous applause. The resolution to replace facilitate with enable and ensure was adopted by unanimous show of hands and a universal stomping of feet, while on the balcony, private acknowledgement was made that perhaps political discourse wasn't always so dull, after all. Bottom of page 69. At the conclusion of the assembly, when the Count and Nina had crawled off the balcony and back into the hallway, the Count felt quite pleased with himself. He felt pleased with his little parallels between the respect payers, back patters, and latecomers of the present and those of the past. He also had a whole host of entertaining alternatives to the phrase enable and ensure, ranging from bustle and trundle to caram and careen. And when Nina inevitably asked what he thought of the day's debate, he was going to reply that it was positively Shakespearean. Shakespearean, that is, in the manner of Dogberry and Much Ado About Nothing. Much Ado About Nothing indeed. Or so the Count intended to quip. But by a stroke of luck, he didn't get the chance. For when Nina asked what he thought of the assembly, unable to wait even a moment for his impressions, she barreled ahead with her own. Wasn't that fascinating? Wasn't it fantastic? Have you ever been on a train? The train is my preferred means of travel, said the Count, somewhat startled. She nodded enthusiastically. Might as well. And when you have traveled by train, have you watched the landscape rolling past the windows and listened to the conversations of your fellow passengers and drifted off to the clacking of the wheels?
I have done all of those things.
Exactly. But have you ever, for even one moment, considered how the coal finds its way into the locomotive's engine? Have you considered in the middle of a forest, or on a rocky slope, how the tracks came to be there in the first place? The Count paused, considered, imagined, admitted. Never. She gave him a knowing look. Isn't it astounding? And when seen in that light, who could disagree? few minutes later, the Count was knocking on the door of Marina, the shy delight, while holding a folded newspaper at the back of his pants. Not long ago, the Count recalled, there had been 3 seamstresses at work in his room, each before an American-made sewing machine. Like the 3 fates together, they had spun and measured and cut, taking in gowns, raising hems, and letting out pants with all of the fateful implications of their predecessors. In the aftermath of the revolution, all 3 had been discharged. The silenced sewing machines had presumably become the property of the people, and the room? It had idled like Fatima's flower shop. For those had not been years for taking in of gowns or the raising of hems any more than they had been for the throwing of bouquets or the sporting of boutonnieres. Then, in 1921, confronted with a backlog of fraying sheets, tattered curtains, and torn napkins, which no one had any intention of replacing, the hotel had promoted Marina, and once again a trustworthy seam was being sewn within the walls of the hotel. "Ah, Marina," said the Count when she opened the door with needle and thread in hand, "how good to find you stitching away in the stitching room." Marina looked at the Count with a touch of suspicion. "What else would I be doing?" "Quite so," said the Count. Then, offering his most endearing smile, he turned 90 degrees, briefly lifted the newspaper, and humbly asked for her assistance. "Didn't I repair a pair of your pants just last week?" "I was spying with Nina again," he explained, "from the balcony of the ballroom." The seamstress looked at the Count with one eye expressing consternation and the other disbelief. "If you're going to clamber about with a 9-year-old girl, why then why do you insist upon wearing pants like those?" The Count was a little taken aback by the seamstress's tone. "When I dressed this morning, it was not my plan to go clamoring about. But either way, I'll have you know that these pants were custom-made on Savile Row." "Yes, custom-made for sitting in a sitting room or drawing in a drawing room." "But I have never drawn in a drawing room." "Which is just as well, since you probably would have spilled the ink." As Marina seemed neither particularly shy nor delightful that day, the Count offered her the bow of one who would now be on his way. "Oh, enough of that," she said. "Behind the screen and off with your pants." Without another word, the Count went behind the dressing screen, stripped to his shorts, and handed Marina his pants. From the ensuing silence, he could tell that she had found her spool, licked her thread, and was carefully directing it through the eye of the needle. "Well," she said, "you might as well tell me what you were doing up in the balcony." So, as Marina began stitching the Count's pants, the laying of locomotive tracks, writ small, if you will, he described the assembly and all his various impressions. Then, almost wistfully, he noted that even as he was seeing the intractability of social conventions and the human tendency to take itself too seriously, Nina was becoming enthralled by the assembly's energy and its sense of purpose. "And what is wrong with that?" "Nothing, I suppose," admitted the Count. "It's just that only a few weeks ago she was inviting me to tea in order to ask about the rules of being a princess." Handing the Count's pants back over the screen, Marina shook her head like one who must now deliver a hard truth to an innocent of mind. "All little girls outgrow their interest in princesses," she said. "In fact, they outgrow their interest in princesses faster than little boys outgrow their interest in clamoring about." All right, part 2. Starting bottom of page 72, I'm hoping my radiator doesn't start wheezing again. All right, here we go. When the Count left Marina's office, with a thanks, a wave, and the seat of his pants intact, he practically fell over one of the bellhops who happened to be standing outside the door. "Excuse me, Count Rostov." "That's quite all right, Petya. No need to apologize. It was my fault, I'm sure." The poor lad, who looked positively wide-eyed, hadn't even noticed that he lost his cap. So, picking it up from the floor and placing it back on the bellhop's head, the Count wished him godspeed in his business and turned to go. But my business is with you. With me. It is Mr. Hideki. He wishes to have a word in his office. No wonder the lad was wide-eyed. Not only had the Count never been summoned by Mr. Hideki in the 4 years he had been in the residence of the Metropole, he had never seen the manager on more than 5 occasions. For Joseph Hideki was one of those rare executives who had mastered the secret of delegation, that is, having assigned the oversight of the hotel's various functions to capable lieutenants, he made himself scarce. Arriving at the hotel at 8:30, he would head straight to his office with a harried expression, as if he were already late for a meeting. Along the way, he would return greetings with an abbreviated nod, and when he passed his secretary, he would inform her, while still in motion, that he was not to be disturbed. Then he would disappear behind his door. And what happened once he was inside his office? It was hard to tell, since so few had seen it. Although those who had caught a glimpse reported that his desk was impressively free of papers, his telephone rarely rang, and along the wall was a burgundy chaise with cushions that were deeply impressed. When the manager's lieutenants had no choice but to knock, due to a fire in the kitchen or a dispute about a bill, the manager would open his door with an expression of such fatigue, such disappointment, such moral defeat, that the interrupters would inevitably feel a surge of sympathy, assure him that they could see to the matter themselves, then apologetically back out the door. As a result, the Metropole ran as flawlessly as any hotel in Europe. Needless to say, the Count was both anxious and intrigued by the manager's sudden desire to see him. Without further ado, Petya led him down the hall, through the hotel's back offices, and finally to the manager's door, which predictably was closed. Expecting Petya to formally announce him, the Count paused a few feet short of the office, but the bellhop made a sheepish gesture toward the door, and then vanished. With no clear alternative, the Count knocked. There followed a brief rustling, a moment of silence, and a beleaguered call to come in. When the Count opened the door, he found Mr. Hideki seated at his desk with a pen firmly in hand, but without a piece of paper in sight. And though the Count was not one to draw conclusions, he did note that the manager's hair was matted on one side of his head, and his reading glasses were crooked on his nose. You wished to see me? Count Rostov, please, come in. As the Count approached one of the two empty chairs that faced the desk, he noted that hanging above the burgundy chaise was a lovely series of hand-tinted engravings depicting hunting scenes in the English style. Those are excellent specimens, the Count said as he took his seat. What's that? Oh, yes, the prince. Quite excellent, yes. But having said this, the manager removed his glasses and ran a hand over his eyes. Then he shook his head and sighed. As he did so, the Count felt a welling of that famed sympathy. How can I be of service to you? Asked the Count on the edge of his seat. The manager gave a nod of familiarity, having presumably heard this question 1,000 times before, then put both hands on his desk. Count Rostov, he began. You have been a guest of this hotel for many years. In fact, I gather your first visit here dates back to the days of my predecessor. That's right, the Count confirmed with a smile. It was in August, 1913. Quite so. Room 215, I believe. Ah, a delightful room. The two men were silent. It has been brought to my attention, the manager continued, if somewhat haltingly, that various members of the staff, when speaking to you, have continued to make use of certain honorifics. Honorifics? Yes, more precisely. I gather they have been addressing you as Your Excellency. The Count considered the manager's assertion for a moment. Well, yes, I suppose that some of your staff addresses me in that fashion. The manager nodded his head, then smiled a little sadly. I'm sure you can see the position that this puts me in. In point of fact, the Count could not see the position that the that this put the manager in. But given the Count's unmitigated feelings of sympathy, he decidedly did not want to put him in any position. So he listened attentively as Mr. Halecki went on. If it were up to me, of course, it goes without saying, but what with... Here. Just when the manager might have pinpointed the most specific of causes, he gave an indefinite twirl of the hand and let his voice drift off. Then he cleared his throat. Naturally, I have little choice but to insist that my staff refrain from using such terms when addressing you. After all, I think we can agree without exaggeration or fear of contradiction that the times have changed. In concluding this, the manager looked to the Count so hopefully that the Count took immediate pains to reassure him. It is the business of the times to change, Mr. Halecki. And it is the business of gentlemen to change with them. The manager looked to the Count with an expression of profound gratitude that someone should understand what he had said so perfectly no further explanation was required. There was a knock at the door, and it opened to reveal Arkady, the hotel's desk captain. The manager's shoulders slumped at the sight of him. He gestured toward the Count. As you can see, Arkady, I am in the midst of a conversation with one of our guests. My apologies, Mr. Halecki, Count Rostov. Arkady bowed to both men, but did not retreat. All right, then, said the manager. What is it? Arkady gave a slight gesture of the head to suggest that he had to relate what he had to relate might best be related in private. Very well. Pushing himself up with both hands, the manager shuffled past his desk, out into the hall, and closed the door such that the Count found himself alone. Your Excellency, the Count reflected philosophically. Your Eminence, Your Holiness, Your Highness. Once upon a time, the use of such terms was a reliable indication that one was in a civilized country. But now, what with... Here the Count gave an indefinite twirl of the hand. Well, it is probably for the best, he said.
This is try number 4 to finish this chapter. The traffic has just been crazy today. Alright, bottom of page 75.
Then rising from his chair, he approached the engravings, which upon closer inspection depicted 3 phases of a fox hunt: the scent, tally-ho, and the chase. In the second print, a young man in stiff black boots and a bright red jacket was blowing on a brass horn that turned a full 360 degrees from its mouthpiece to its bell. Without a doubt, the horn was a carefully crafted object expressive of beauty and tradition, but was it essential to the modern world? For that matter, did we really need a crew of nattily dressed men, pure red horses, and well-trained dogs to corner a fox in a hole? Without exaggeration or fear of contradiction, the Count could answer his own question in the negative. For the times do, in fact, change. They change relentlessly, inevitably, inventively. And as they change, they set into bright relief not only outmoded honorifics and taunting horns, but silver summoners and mother-of-pearl opera glasses and all manner of carefully crafted things that have outlived their usefulness. Carefully crafted things that have outlived their usefulness, thought the Count. I wonder. Moving quietly across the room, the Count put an ear to the door, where he could hear the voices of the manager, Arkady, and a third party talking outside. Though muted, their tones suggested they were still a few steps from resolution. Quickly, the Count returned to the wall with the etchings and counted 2 panels beyond the depiction of the chase. Placing his hand in the center of the panel, he gave a firm push. The panel depressed slightly when a click sounded. The Count pulled back his fingers, and the panel popped open, revealing a hidden cabinet. Inside, just as the Grand Duke had described, was an inlaid box with brass fittings. Reaching into the cabinet, the Count gently lifted the lid of the box and there they were, perfectly crafted and peacefully at rest. Marvelous, he said. Simply marvelous. That's the end of that chapter. I can't do any more today because it took me maybe 6 different times of stopping and starting the videos to avoid the terrible traffic sounds. I just don't know when best to record when I'm not working or whatever. So my deepest apologies for all the noise, and I really had to read loudly at the end there to overcome the noise. So we'll start next time on page 77, Archaeologies. I hope you're enjoying it. I really enjoy this book. I'm so sad that the recording is not going as well as I might hope. But anyway, we'll see you next time, and hope you're having a good week. Bye.